Welcome to Crossroads, the infrastructure podcast. This is your host, Andrew Vitelli, senior editor of Energy in the Americas for InfraLogic. Thank you for tuning in. Joining us today is David Reister, a managing partner at Segway Sustainable Infrastructure. David, thank you for joining the podcast.
Happy to be here, Andrew.
So today we are going to discuss the One Big Beautiful Bill that was signed into law this past weekend. We're recording this on July 9th. Now, Segway has done some really good detailed analysis of what the impact of that bill is likely to be, both for renewable investment and for deployment. And that's one of the reasons that I was really eager to have David on. But before we get into that, David, can you tell me a little bit about your background in the renewable energy industry?
Sure, Andrew. So I have spent most of my career in renewable energy. I had a few years in venture capital in the first 5 years of my career, but then shifted over in the early days of Sun Edison into the solar and broader renewable space. That whole time, I've either been bouncing between project finance roles or investment roles on various investment teams. So I'm kind of a token finance guy, but over the years, I've certainly become pretty competent in a lot of the areas of development and build-own-operating of solar power plants. The group I co-founded at Sun Edison was called the Global Special Situations Group, very grandiosely named, and we spun out from there and created an investment firm called GSSG Solar, which was the start of my sort of development capital investment experience. We focused on the Japanese market at a time when there was a very lucrative feed-in tariff there. I've also spent some years running project finance teams, including the project finance team at Cypress Creek, kind of during its heyday. When I left there in 2019, I wanted to bring some of the success we had at GSSG Solar doing development stage investments and bring that into the US and Canadian markets. Through my whole career, I was always sitting in the spot where people were asking me to find development capital for pre-construction. And it was always the scarcest thing, the sticky gear in the machine. And we figured out how to do it well in Japan. And I wanted to bring that to the US market. That's what Segway is. It's a strategy focused on the pre-NTP phases of a project for solar, wind, storage, and transmission projects. It's a private equity structure. We were founded about 4 years ago, currently investing out of our second fund. We have about $300 million in assets under management. By design, it kind of has to be that size or smaller because the check sizes tend to be fairly small. So it's a little bit of a stay small and stay very focused sort of strategy. We've got 14 people. Half of them are in San Francisco. Half are scattered around. And yeah, we make investments at all stages of development. Sure, sometimes it's just posting a few deposits 3 months before NTP, but more frequently, it's an earlier stage investment. Sometimes as early as just some smart people with a circle on a map. But in all cases, we partner with a frontline development partner. Sometimes that's just one person. Sometimes it's a bigger shop of 40, 50 people. When you make these early stage investments, you know, it's fairly expensive money. We're prepared to lose all of our money on projects that die. And that does happen. So there aren't that many groups doing this because it's a pretty uncomfortable strategy for a lot of folks that have been underwriting to protecting the downside for their whole career. This is a situation where you're not always going to be able to protect your downside and you need to have a few things that go really well. We sell at NTP or dev complete somewhere in that zone. And when we sell, the liquidity is sort of shared between us and our frontline development partner. But sometimes that's nothing. Sometimes it's a failure. Sometimes things go really well and we get a 5X. But in the aggregate, of course, one hopes that the fund level returns come up pretty good. And so far they have. Expensive money, but developers keep their autonomy. They have aligned capital partners, a pretty useful group of people that want the same results. And you get a chance to maximize your project value by carrying it deeper into the development cycle. And I think that business model has been generally well received. But of course, the connection to what we're talking about here is that we constantly make decisions about whether to keep projects alive or kill them. And they're very difficult decisions, always. And this bill makes it a lot harder. It introduces a number of new variables into figuring out, can and should this project carry on further and get more capital support? And that's why we decided to do the analysis, because it's one of the things we do every day is figure out what is the risk-adjusted return of moving this project along and how do we make those decisions at a portfolio level such that we get good aggregate returns. And it's a tricky part of the job, and it's particularly tricky right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, we've we've seen a lot of people and spoken to a lot of people who are opinionated and have views of what's going to happen with the One Big Beautiful Bill throughout the process, but very few have put it into numbers and done the type of detailed analysis that I think Segway has. And Segway's really done it every step of the way, from the first time something passed out of the House to the Senate bill. So we've been able to see how the potential impact changes as there are changes to the bill. So looking now that we have a final bill that's been signed, can you give a little bit of a synopsis about how you think what we ended up with is likely to impact the industry?
Of course, it's still a slightly moving target because we're all taking educated guesses at what this executive order means for the ultimate Treasury guidance. But the battle to get this bill to limit the damage as much as possible was very focused on having a start of construction standard with a long enough window to allow folks to, in an organized and diligent fashion, decide which projects sort of deserved and warranted the investment necessary to safe harbor the projects to get the 30% ITC. And the start of construction standard offers a little bit more flexibility than just a hard placed in service cliff on the back end, which would, of course, make construction financing very difficult because there's just this binary risk, the sort of Damocles kind of hanging out there for you. With a start of construction standard, you probably end up having a longer window as far as when projects are actually finished, whether or not they still get the ITC or not. And that was really the main focus, together with keeping transferability in the mix, because transferability has proven really healthy for the market. And then, of course, getting storage carved out, which somewhere along the way, we realized that it didn't quite have the same stigmas on it as solar and wind had it. And there was a pathway to get it kind of carved out from all this. So it's a very weird place to be demonized in this fashion as a sector. And we're all sort of licking our wounds because, let's just say, some very big punches were just landed and it looks like they're not quite done.
Can you quantify it? What would you say are the headline numbers in terms of what impact this bill is going to have 2 years from now, 5 years from now? How much less renewables is going to end up on the grid? And how many less dollars are going to go into the sector based on what we know now?
Yeah, I think so. Our estimate on the last, on the bill that was passed, is that they're relative to status quo, and our status quo line is complicated because it includes sort of a pretty healthy dose of projects that are currently in the queue dying of natural causes, as we call them, which is to say not from an exogenous policy event like this, but just, you know, dying because they can't get a permit, or dying because the interconnection costs are too expensive, or dying because you can't find somebody to pay for the electricity. Those are sort of natural causes of death, and those establish our status quo line, which over the next 5 years, that status quo line has a little over 500 gigawatts being placed in service in the U.S. market. Our final analysis of the bill had a little less than 100 gigawatts of that being canceled. Those lines were worse. We've put out some graphs that kind of show in the different versions of the bill how it moved around. This is the second best of all the different versions put out, was this last bill, but it's still an awful lot of capacity that's killed. It's $141 billion of canceled investment. A lot of the storage that's carved out from this is going to become less interesting, which is something that we have not quite quantified in there, is what, you know, sort of diminishing returns on storage if you have less solar and wind coming on the grid. It's a big deal. It lands in a sort of probably short of a catastrophe spot, where at one point we were estimating as much as 240 gigawatts in the House bill. That was our estimate for the canceled power plants, would be 245 gigawatts. So relative to that House bill, this is about a third as damaging. And that's mostly due to the start of construction standard that ended up making it into the final bill, which was extremely hard fought. But we'll see. Part of our analysis made a big assumption, right? Which was that the references in the bill to old IRS notices about what start of construction actually means, the lawmakers obviously intended for this bill to pick up that same very well-established standard. And we now have an executive order out that is explicitly saying they don't want that standard to be applied. And there are versions of how this plays out from here, where our estimate of a little under 100 gigawatts being canceled ends up being way too optimistic, because the start of construction standard won't really mean anything if they change the definition of that in a very severe way.
That's interesting. And obviously, that's kind of a new development. I think even a new development since your latest analysis came out, correct?
Correct.
Going back to the analysis, though, when you look at the, let's say, lost gigawatts that are expected, what are the main drivers of that? What are the clauses or law changes that are going to be most damaging?
So the right way to think about this, and it gets a little bit nuanced, something a lot of people said to me over the last 6 weeks is, if there's all this demand out there, which is what you're telling me is true, and that's why we can't pass this bill that cuts off a lot of capacity, there's all this demand that needs to be served, and you're telling me that wind and solar are, from an LCOE standpoint, the cheapest and quickest way to get power available to off-takers on the grid, such as a data center, then what's the problem? Why don't you just accept the end of the subsidy? If your product is that good and there's all this demand, what's the problem? And the problem is of a sequencing nature. That point is well taken, and I think in the long term, correct. In the long term sort of equilibrium, maybe 8 to 10 years out, something like that, we don't need a subsidy. And competing on a level playing field with all other forms of power, there will be many, many applications and places in America where solar and wind installations will play a huge role, usually coupled with storage. The problem is what happens on the way there and how much we fall behind in all of the sectors that require a lot of power. And the sequencing problem I'm talking about is this. At the time that you need to decide to put more money into a project, you've got a $2 million need or a $10 million posting, right? You have to look into the future and assess the probability that the project ends up having value, margin in it, how far out you think that's going to be, and what that value creation looks like, right? The probability of a win and what the win looks like and when it arrives. At the time that we are asked to make a lot of these big investment decisions in projects that are impacted by the bill, we won't know certain things like how quickly is the demand side of the market going to understand that they need to absorb higher prices because supply is going down and the cost of that supply is going up. Will they understand that immediately? Some will. Some of the data center developers understand exactly what's happening, and they're saying, I'll sign the new price. I need the power. But a lot of the off-takers of electricity are regulated or stubborn or less sophisticated, and they don't know what price they should renegotiate it to. And therefore, you don't know if you have a project that's worth anything, right? So if you have a project right now out in 2030, and this is true for us in 10 or so cases, we got a PPA for a project that's meant to place in service in 2030. And somebody, you know, the off-taker comes to us, or the utility that's doing the interconnection comes to us and says, okay, you got to post $30 million of deposits across these two projects. A lot of it's going to be at risk. So you have to come up with the money and you have to expose it to possibility of losing it if you don't finish the project. But the PPAs that we won were set to prices from 4 months ago that assumed a 30% ITC would be in place. Now, in the end, does that off-taker need the power enough to behave rationally and renegotiate the price that's in the PPA? Maybe, probably, in a lot of cases, yes. But we won't know that in that example and many others. We won't know the answer to that until well after the time that we have to invest a significant amount of money into the project to keep it alive. And that sort of timing sequencing problem, in the end, yes, we probably end up fine in most cases, but which ones are the most that work out, and which ones are the ones where you can't find a agreeable price for electricity with an off-taker? We don't know which are which, and you can't just take a leap off of a cliff with that saying, it'll work out in the end with some of these check sizes. They're really significant amounts of money that completely rely upon, in the end, an off-taker paying 25, 30% more than they were paying before for the electricity. And you just don't know if and when the answer to that will be, yes, they're ready. And so a lot of projects will die. You have to be a responsible fiduciary. Doing that is gambling. It's not investing, right? I can't put that amount of capital exposed to something I have absolutely no control over that won't reveal itself for a couple of years.
So David, just to a little bit flesh out the other side of that discussion, The argument is that because of data centers, AI, there's a growing need for power. And other than renewables, when you look at the next 5 years, there's just nothing that's going to be ready. So at the end of the day, these off-takers need that power, and they're not going to be able to use other sources. Nuclear is not ready, coal is not realistic, and gas turbines, the components are not going to be available until 2029, 2030 at the earliest. So at the end of the day, they're going to need that power, and whatever the economics pencil out at, that's what they're going to pay. So what you're saying is that it'll take more time for that equilibrium to be reached than it will than the time you have to make those decisions. Am I summarizing that accurately?
Yes, that's right. I think that equilibrium or proof of that theory will arrive with time, slowly, and it's not going to be true in every instance, right? And that sort of equilibrium of they need the power and you're the only ones that can build it in this next 5-year window, therefore this has to work out. It sounds right. It is right in a microeconomics 201 class, but in practice, supply doesn't always meet demand at the local level perfectly, right? We may have developed a project thinking could be a data center off-taker, but this utility will probably want it. It's not always developed directly to the sort of demand that is likely to hell or high water their way to saying yes to a new price. To what extent exactly that hypothesis is true, which is that they'll have no other choice but to pay whatever they need to pay for this electricity, while we wait for that to prove itself out or come into focus, a lot of investment decisions have to be made that are very hard to responsibly make if you don't know which of those projects are going to clear in this sort of new market. It might be that half of our projects, in the end, there's an off-taker that says, I don't want to pay this much more, but I have to. Which half is it? We don't know. It's very hard to know at this point when you've got a project that's going to place in service in 4 years. So you end up just kind of shrugging your shoulders and saying, I don't control this outcome. It's going to work out a lot of the time, but not all the time. What do I do with that?
So maybe a rough parallel. It was a little bit of a different situation. But a few years ago, we had basically a slew of PPAs that had been reached at a certain price with the assumption that costs would keep coming down. And then you had some of the supply chain issues. You had inflation. And it became clear that the projects just could not be built economically at those PPA prices. And you saw a lot of renegotiations. How is this different? And are there ways that this is similar than that? If anything, you have kind of this one big event that might be easier to predict in some ways, right?
Yeah, I think that comp from 2021 is a good one. It's the best one we have. And that experience, I think, surprised a lot of developers and investors in portfolios of projects in that the price inelasticity was more favorable than we all imagined, or most of us imagined. That is to say, off-takers were more willing to change their price than people thought they would be. And many moved quicker than we thought they would. But here's the thing, there's sort of a selection bias with that. The stories that you hear about from that era are the ones where somebody changed their PPA price and it all worked out great in the end. You don't have a lot of people going around telling the story about the projects that they unceremoniously killed because the cost went up by 22 cents and they sort of just decided they had to focus on other ones where the off-taker was willing to change the price. There were plenty of examples of projects that died because of the era of supply chain tightness there. You just don't hear about it as much, right? People don't tell those stories. If you knew that that supply chain problem was going to arrive in 2017, you could take some educated guesses as to, hey, in which of these situations is the off-taker I plan to sell this electricity to going to basically be up against a wall and say like, well, I'll pay whatever you need me to pay to make this project work because it's in my plans and I need it. You could take some educated guesses, and that's what we're doing right now, where you say, I think the probability of a price inelastic off-taker is higher here. I bet I'll get them to pay whatever it takes. But you don't know. They're just educated guesses, right? Because in a lot of these situations, if you do have a PPA, it's probably one that you got with a utility via a competitive RFP. And those are the parties that are probably going to take a long time to show their cards as far as what they're willing to do on price and if they have to rerun the RFP. In short, that comp is definitely relevant and it does inspire some optimism and steal one up to take a few chances. A lot of people lost a lot of money on projects that got hung up in that era too.
That's true. I mean, there were many projects were affected. There was in some cases a slowdown. So yeah, it's not a perfectly sanguine projection in that sense. Now, when you talk about the need for power looking forward, it's about the fact that there's going to be more data centers on the grid, more power needed because of AI. And like we've discussed, there's not a great alternative. So if all these projects are canceled, if this 18% or what have you of projects that were expected to be needed to meet demand all of a sudden are scrapped because of uncertainty, what's that going to mean? Is that going to mean that we're not going to have enough power on the grid? Is it going to mean that data centers are not built? Do you have any sense of how that's going to play out?
I think it just means that fewer data centers are going to get built. I think it's as simple as that. You know, right now it's complete chaos, right? All the data centers are either trying to do behind the meter private use networks, you know, one out of 50 of those work because you need a million things to go right. Or you're trying to get your power from the grid where you sort of say, here's my power plan, but ultimately you're coming to a deal with the RTO about large new load interconnection. And right now, there's already tons of data centers that have put in that interconnection request. They stand ready to post their deposits. The utility likes the idea, or the RTO likes the idea of them coming online. But there's a huge queue on the load side, and the math doesn't work. There isn't enough power to meet all that new demand. It is already a huge problem, as anyone knows who is doing data centers. All that's going to happen now is the same phenomenon. It's just going to get more severe. The gate for new load will open up less than it is right now. That is to say, you already have a long line of aspiring data centers saying, I need to be new load on your grid. I'm a big new power player. Please facilitate delivery of electricity to me. You already have a huge line of those people with just a leak of them making it through as far as getting what they need to have power for their data center. That trickle is going to get even slower. Where the rubber hits the road is that data center build out is going to slow down at a time when everybody wants it to be accelerating.
That's interesting. And to kind of conclude, David, as a investor yourself, how are you dealing with this uncertainty? Obviously, part of that is a lot of planning and a lot of research that you've been publishing. But how are you approaching this period?
I mean, you kind of have to take each decision on its own. We have a mixture, you know, we kind of have separated all of our projects into essentially three different categories, right? One of them is this project is fine getting its ITC without changing our behavior decisions or actions in the near term. On the other extreme, there's a, okay, well, we obviously should kill this one because it's not going to place in service for 6 years. We probably have to put $20 million into it to get there. It's just too many unknowns. We've only put a couple hundred K into it. We just got to cut it. It's going to be a lot of those. So those are two categories. And then there's the stuff in the middle, which is the hard part, where you say, this could end up fine. But you have to look at what do we have to put into it? How much risk are we exposed to? What's the reward if we're right? And how long do we have to wait until we see the answer? And we're basically going to triage that list. We're going to force rank them all based on those four questions. Going to say, all right, this is the hard group. This is the 45 projects that are hard. Let's look at those four questions and kind of force rank them in our mind. And we're going to capitalize, you know, the top 40% of them or something like that, whatever. I don't know exactly how we're going to decide where that line is, but it's going to be something like that. And then you just have to do your best to get the safe harboring right, which is not looking like an easy task at the moment. And, you know, limit your exposure until the cards flip over that tell you if you're going to be all right in a non-ITC world. So it's hard. We're figuring it out as we go. We've been kind of in these spots before. The industry has had a lot of situations like this where things get really fuzzy as you gaze to the horizon. And so we're pretty good at this as a sector. I feel like I've been here before, but I don't like it. It's very uncomfortable and it's impossible to get all these decisions right. So we're going to have to be prepared to have a few losses that arise from procuring some transformers for projects that don't make it. Like that is simply going to happen. And accepting that is an important part of what's going on. And then we have to believe that scarcity will drive increased margins for the projects that do make it. you know, the projects that we support, and we are right to do so. It's probably true that they will garner higher purchase prices when we sell them because the universe is thinning out. So I believe that's true. And I believe that in the end, our fund's probably not going to do as well as I thought it was 7 weeks ago, but I think it's still going to do fine because supply and demand will lead to the surviving projects being worth more in the end. And that's kind of what we're aiming for. And we're trying to manage the risk the best we can while we do that.
Well, that's interesting. And obviously a lot more we could talk about when it comes to the start of construction guidance, but I think we're running out of time here. But before we end, I'd imagine a lot of listeners would be interested in seeing some of this data. Where can they find it? I know I see it on LinkedIn. Is there a way that they can look at some of these charts and some of this analysis?
A lot of it's fairly proprietary. I mean, the way that we sort of dig through different parts of the interconnection queue, assess the probability of a project making it is, you know, we put a lot into that. So putting our grand model out into the world is something we're probably not going to do. And sharing some of the main findings is kind of where we decided to land on that. But, you know, a lot of the data comes from scraping from public information in various queues. A lot of it came from Orenia, who we use to kind of do a lot of that aggregation of data and the filtering and framing of data. There is some LCOE models that are feeding into this a little bit, you know, Wood Mackenzie's, NREL's, Orenia's LCOE models. You know, I think somebody needs to be doing LCOE models that create like a composite project of solar, storage, and wind that is dispatchable and deliverable in its combination, and understanding what it's going to take for that to be cost competitive with a natural gas plant. That sort of has been done. That's a smart way to look at it as far as thinking about how close we are to grid parity at different parts of the country without an ITC.
So where could people go just to see kind of the headline numbers? Is that on your website or is it someplace else?
Yes, we have it on our website. It's www.segueinfra.com/insights. That page is a repository of my bloviating and analysis that we're willing to share. And there's a lot in there, including this set of four sort of research analysis that we put out related to these different bills, including the final one. So those are all in there. And you can get the headline numbers there and kind of some of the commentary around them.
Great. Well, thank you. Certainly I think the industry really appreciates that resource. And David, thank you for taking the time today. I think it's been a really interesting conversation. Obviously, there's still a lot of question marks, but I think that it's something that we're going to have to continue to follow.
No, thanks for having me. It was fun, Andrew, and this will be evolving every day. So by the time this comes out, I probably have a different view on it. I think everybody's going to have to adapt as they go. And thanks for creating a conversation around it.
Well, thank you again. And thank you, listeners, for tuning into Crossroads. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast player. And please give us a 5-star rating so others can find our podcast. Until next time, this has been Crossroads.